Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What lies in the secret files of MI5? The British Security Service recently celebrated its 100th anniversary and marked the occasion by allowing historian Christopher Andrew nearly unfettered access to a century of records. His new book traces the evolution of Military Intelligence Section 5 from a small team of anti-espionage specialists into a powerful, sometimes controversial force of more than 3,000 that exists today. Christopher Andrew is professor of modern and contemporary history at Cambridge University. The new book is called Defend the Realm, A Centenary History of MI5. Chris, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Until very recently, MI5 had been famously, if not infamously, secretive. What was behind the decision to allow you or anybody to come in from the outside and make some of that history public?
Well, I think the following thinking. Once upon a time, people were content if governments didn't tell them what was going on, simply to say, well, we mustn't know what's going on. What happens nowadays is that if governments don't give their citizens some reliable idea of what's going on, the space that is filled by reliable information is filled by extraordinary conspiracy theories. You know, after all, in the United States until recently, perhaps even now, a majority of Americans believed that the CIA had killed John F. Kennedy. Well, we don't want those kind of conspiracy theories to spread in the United Kingdom. And one way of attempting to stop it happening is to allow somebody, and by great good fortune, it was me, to go through the files and report what actually happened.
Now, you actually had to sign on with the agency in order to have this access. What kinds of conditions
were laid out? I did. It wasn't so much having to sign on, but here's the deal. You know, I'm a historian. I've been visiting professor at Harvard and various other places in the United States. I like teaching in the States as well as in Britain. I wasn't too keen on joining an intelligence agency. But the reason I changed my mind is this. If you go into any organization as an outsider, people don't talk to you. And it doesn't matter, you know, whether it's a radio station or an intelligence service. People don't talk to you in the same way that they do if you're, at least for a period, a member of the service, and they think that, you know, they can talk to you and you're going to understand. So I do think that while I was writing this book, being a member of MI5, which was pretty exciting, I could tell you, actually I learned more than I would have done if I'd remained somebody just leaving Cambridge University from time to time and going into their forbidden headquarters.
What sense did you get of the culture within MI5 that you think you wouldn't have had you been that sort of outside expert coming in?
Well, some of it is going to sound surprising and I think perhaps even frivolous to an American audience. And it's this. One of the things was that they have a considerable sense of humor and they looked for that from the very beginning. Now, that may seem, you know, I think, you know, for anyone for whom that's a new and a strange idea, needs some time to think about it. But the reason is this. If you are dealing with desperate, desperate material, anyone dealing with threatened terrorist attacks to the United Kingdom, you know, several 9/11s have been averted in the United Kingdom. If you don't have some kind of sense of humor, then you lack the proportion, the sense of proportion, to be able to deal with these things. So I think that that was the culture that surprised me most. The other thing I would say, don't know that this surprised me so much, is how well-motivated they are. Now, the Security Service employs the same outside contractors to come and look at job satisfaction within the Security Service. And I was considerably surprised to discover that it was probably higher than anywhere else within the British governmental system.
For Americans who might not be familiar, can you give us the specific directives of MI5?
The specific directives of MI5 are summed up in the title of the book, which is to defend the realm. The coat of arms of MI5, personally approved by Her Majesty the Queen, are in Latin, regnum defendi, defend the realm. Now, what has changed over 100 years is, of course, the things that were the threats to national security before and during the First World War, and this is why MI5 was founded. It was German spies. And if German spies had known where British troops were going to join in the First World War in 1914, well, then the First World War, which was almost lost in the West in the first 6 weeks, would have been a good deal more likely to be lost, but they didn't. And now if we fast forward to the 21st century, there is the problem of Islamist terrorism. And in a generation's time, it will be different once again. So the purpose of the security service is not to arrest people. It doesn't have the power that the FBI does. We don't have any organization like the FBI, which is both a federal police force and a security service. We have two different organizations. Is to defend the realm against whatever the current threats are, and it's perfectly clear what the current threat is.
Let's talk for a minute in more detail about the earliest origins. 1909, the organization was founded. This was a time when Britain was terrified of the threat from Kaiser Wilhelm.
That's right. And at one level, it was terrified too much, because it's usually the case that if you're ignorant about a threat, you exaggerate it. And the threat from German espionage 5 years before the outbreak of the First World War was exaggerated. But MI5, partly with the assistance of Winston Churchill, the first British politician to take a serious interest in intelligence, nonetheless managed by the time of the First World War to track down all the German spies in Britain. All those of any significance were arrested at the outbreak of war. And this meant that what the Germans were desperate to have, which is information about when and where we were going to cross the channel to assist the French, they didn't get. And my book contains a verbatim account of what the then Emperor of Germany, Germany was still an empire, not a republic at that point, Kaiser Wilhelm the Second, said to his head of intelligence when he discovered that all his spies had been wrapped up. He was not pleased.
How was early intelligence gathered in a time before any sort of modern technology that we imagine people doing this work have today?
Well, in some ways, the same as nowadays. That is to say, simply one of the best methods was to intercept people's communications. And the only difference is that in those far-off days, people used to write letters. And MI5, before the First World War, discovered the contact addresses of German spies in Britain, in Germany itself. So they simply opened all the letters from German spies to German intelligence, and all the letters from German intelligence to German spies in Britain. Now, that's not too dissimilar from intercepting communications nowadays, except, of course, they're far more likely to be emails than letters.
Of course, there were also concerns near this time about Russian nihilists. Can you talk about the MI5's operations against them?
Absolutely. It tends to be forgotten now, but the period over the last 100 and some years, when there were most assassinations of political leaders, it's not nowadays, not since the Second World War, certainly not in the 21st century. No, it was at the end of the 19th century and at the beginning of the 21st century, beginning of the 20th century, and of course they included President McKinley in the United States. So one of the terrorist threat, curiously, 100 years ago, a little bit more than 100 years ago, the chief targets were actually heads of state and heads of government. And there were all series that were killed, rather more in Russia than anywhere else. But, of course, Russian terrorists spread across Europe, and so they were a problem in continental Europe and, indeed, to a much lesser extent, in Britain, as well as in Russia.
How did MI5, especially early in its history in the 20th century, recruit its operatives?
Well, I think that by the time it really got around to recruiting large numbers, which was in the First World War, I think one of the things that may surprise people most, particularly in the United States, is that it was the first part of British government which made a serious attempt to recruit women, which is probably why it stopped during the First World War, were among the ablest anywhere in Britain. If we fast forward to the end of the 20th century, the first female head of any of the world's major intelligence services, Stella Remington, became head of MI5 in 1992. At the beginning of the 21st century, or shortly afterwards, another woman became head of MI5. Now, that has not happened to the CIA. It's not happened to the FBI. And one can trace that back to the First World War. Let me give you an example of a career which couldn't have happened in the United States and which I don't think could have happened anywhere else in Britain. 16-year-old secretary. Her name was Jane Sismore. She was recruited straight from school in 1916. 8 years later, she had qualified in her spare time as a barrister. She was an officer of MI5, and she was head of the Soviet department. And this was at a period when Russia, a.k.a. the Soviet Union as it was then, was the chief target of British intelligence. Now, I don't think anywhere else in the Western world there was a 24-year-old woman who had gone that far in intelligence. Now, it's not a straight path from her to the late 20th century and the appointment of the world's first women as head of MI5. But it begins in the First World War.
Can you talk for a little bit about, I know Germany remained a primary focus of MI5's operations through the end of the Second World War. Tell us a little bit about the double cross operations and how they worked.
Well, once again, I mean, it's going to sound a little bit frivolous, but the British have from time to time been extremely good at practical jokes. Now, if you're going to fool somebody, if you're going to deceive somebody, once again, a sense of humor is really, really important. And during the Second World War, Britain managed to detect and arrest every single German spy who landed in Britain, with the exception of one poor man who committed suicide before he could be arrested. Now, they were all interrogated, and the best of them were turned into the so-called double-cross system, feeding continuous disinformation, which fooled not merely the German high command, but Hitler in person. So let's fast forward. 6th of June 1944, a date of extreme importance in U.S. history as well as in British history. This was the biggest amphibious operation in the history of the world until that point. It's U.S. and British troops, commanded by the future President General Eisenhower, who land on the Normandy beaches and begin the liberation of German-occupied France. Well, that could not have happened because we were heavily, heavily outnumbered by the Germans. Unless we'd managed to persuade the Germans that this was just a diversion, that the real attack was going to come in the nearest part of France to Britain, that's to say the Calais region. Who's the person who most persuaded Hitler and the high command? Well, he was a double agent. He was given the code name Garbo because Garbo was the greatest film star of the time, and he was the greatest star. And not merely was Hitler fooled by him, Hitler took the personal decision to award Garbo the Iron Cross, the highest German military decoration. Now, what happens when a message is radioed to Garbo from his German intelligence controllers that he's been awarded the Iron Cross? He says, he replies with a brief radio message which says, "I am so overcome by emotion that I cannot put my feelings into words." What is actually going on is that he was writhing around on the floor, absolutely helpless with laughter.
Christopher Andrew is my guest. He's professor of modern and contemporary history at Cambridge University. His new book is called Defend the Realm, A Centenary History of MI5. We'll resume the conversation in a moment and invite you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at Cambridge University, Christopher Andrew. His new book is called Defend the Realm, A Centenary History of MI5. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. I want to jump back a little bit in time here, Chris, and ask you about something. Is it true that Benito Mussolini found himself indirectly on the MI5 payroll for a time?
Oh, absolutely. This was a period, however, when MI5 and British Foreign Intelligence, MI6, had pretty much the same representative in Italy at the end of the First World War, subsequently became British Secretary of State, in other words, Foreign Secretary. And what we were desperate to do was to keep Italy in the war on our side. And Mussolini was a journalist, and he was paid fairly large amounts of money to support the British and American war effort. I doubt if he gave value for money.
Christopher Andrew is my guest. Our number, 1-800-933-5372. Our first caller today is Robbie in Plano. Hi, Robbie.
Yes, hi. Thank you. My question for your guest is, did MI5 try to spy on any of the nationalist leaders that were fighting to overthrow the British imperialism, and if you came across any prominent double agents?
You're talking about in India?
Yes, specifically India, but anywhere in the world.
Chris?
Absolutely. And there's lots about them. Very interesting question, Robbie. Such an interesting question that I'll try and keep my mentions short. There were some Indians, in particular one of Nehru, the first Prime Minister, as you know, of independent India, Krishna Menon, one of his more radical supporters. But I think the ones that he kept closest track on were the leaders of the independence movements in Africa, in particular Jomo Kenyatta, who led the independence movement in East Africa, in Kenya in particular, and Kwame Nkrumah, who led the independence movement in West Africa, Gold Coast, it was called then, and Ghana. But the impact that the surveillance had is actually not what one might expect, because both Nkrumah and Kenyatta had communist connections. And what MI5 discovered by bugging the headquarters of the British Communist Party was that both had got utterly fed up with the communists. In other words, the result of bugging them was really rather reassuring. And the kind of anecdote, for example, that MI5 reported to the British government was that Kenyatta, when he'd been to the Lenin School in Moscow in the early 1930s to be turned into a proper communist and learn how to engage in underground activity, he'd got completely fed up with Stalinist Russia, as indeed most sensible people did. And he was accused of being, somebody said to him, "You're just a petty bourgeois," to which Jomo Kenyatta replied, "Not so much of the petty, call me a big bourgeois." almost unresearched area of the ending of the British biggest empire in the history of the world, the British Empire, which used to cover a quarter of the globe. And what MI5 learned by spying on some of the independence leaders, I think, is pretty interesting.
How did MI5 position itself against the activities of the Provisional IRA?
In a pretty confusing way. And the reason for this is this. For historical reasons, when the troubles began in Northern Ireland, as they're called, in other words, the IRA campaigns in 1969, MI5 did not have the lead role against the IRA, either in Northern Ireland or even in mainland Britain. In mainland Britain, because terrorist attacks by Irish Republicans went back to the Victorian era, it was the Metropolitan Police, in other words, the London Police, who had the lead role. So it's not until the 1990s that MI5 has the lead role against the IRA. Now, you know, this is a sad story with, in the end, I think, a happy ending. But I would say the IRA came closer to victory in its attacks against London in the 1990s than at any previous period. Why? because it had, at long last, a coherent strategy. And the coherent strategy, at the time when the City of London, apart from which was not suspect in those days because it was full of bankers, but was the pride and glory of the British economy, we were then, the City of London was, after all, Europe's, if and perhaps more than Europe's, leading financial capital. And the IRA's plan was to blow up so many foreign financial headquarters in London that the rest would leave. And they came fairly close to it. They destroyed two major institutions, but they were caught by MI5 before they could go on. And they were only caught by MI5 because after they made their second attempt to assassinate a British prime minister and came pretty close, they come fairly close against Margaret Thatcher. But Margaret Thatcher's successor, John Major, they came very close indeed. And it was at that point that the lead role against the IRA was transferred to MI5. And I think they made an enormous difference.
What did it take, Chris, for MI5 to make the transition from the threats of the Second World War to those of the Cold War?
Well, I think, you know, you just have to be adaptable. I mean, my goodness, there is no walk of life nowadays, no profession in which people don't have to be adaptable. I mean, the era of the Internet has done to print journalism is, I think, no more nor less than the end of the Cold War and the beginning of the era of transnational terrorism has done to intelligence services. So, in other words, in whatever walk of life you are, if you're not adaptable, you're going to fail. And fortunately, the security service, I think, has been adaptable. One of the reasons, however, I think that it enabled it to adapt was that by the time the Cold War ended, there were already 20 years' experience of dealing with the IRA. Now, even though MI5 did not have the lead role in Britain, it actually had the lead role outside Britain. So when when the IRA attacked British targets on the continent of Europe, MI5 did deal with them. It also had an important role in monitoring arms supplies and money from supporters of the IRA in the United States. Now, if at the very moment when the Berlin Wall had fallen down in November 1989, MI5, despite being adaptable, had to move from one day to the next, from counter-espionage to counter-terrorism, I think it would have had real difficulty in doing it. But it was, of all the major Western intelligence services by that stage, the one, even though it didn't have complete experience in counter-terrorism, it probably had more experience in counter-terrorism than any of the others. And that, I think, is why it's made the adaptation.
It was, of course, during the Cold War that MI5 had a great deal of trouble with a group of traitors from within its ranks known as the Cambridge Five. Can you talk about how they managed to do so much damage?
Right. Well, of course, you're referring to people from my own university, Cambridge University. I shouldn't be too frivolous about this, but one of the things that distinguishes Cambridge University is it's produced some really tremendously able intelligence officers, but alas, intelligence officers for both sides in the Cold War, the Russian side as well as the British side. Why were they so difficult to deal with? Well, I thought the problem had been that all of them got into the so-called Magnificent Five, Kim Philby and his friends, got into positions of power and influence in the British corridors of power, and in four cases, actually, in the British intelligence community, before there was proper vetting. In other words, before there was proper investigation of people when they joined intelligence agencies. So this meant that after the Second World War, even though Kim Philby, the most important of all of them, would never have got into the post-war British intelligence community, he was already there. And this meant that in 1949, he's a very bright man, he became British Foreign Intelligence, MI6, representative in Washington and betrayed American secrets as well as British secrets. The same, of course, was true of the United States. We got into the business of investigating people before they join intelligence agencies far too late.
Interestingly, one of the members of the Cambridge Five, Anthony Blunt, wrote a memoir of his own life that was just released, I think, last summer.
Anthony Blunt had simply extraordinary career. The memoir of his life that he wrote is a good deal less frank, actually, than his file in MI5. His file in MI5 is 50 volumes long. It's absolutely fascinating. And it reveals a number of... he was only active as a Soviet spy, even though he did odd jobs for them during the Second World War. But during the Second World War, we were talking a little while earlier about the double-cross system, this extraordinary system run mainly by MI5 of deceiving the Germans. Well, it was Anthony Blunt who drew up the summary of what was going on for the British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill got the 2.5-page version. Joseph Stalin probably got the 20-page version. So the sad thing about Anthony Blunt is that he was reporting on one of the greatest intelligence successes in British history, not simply to the British Prime Minister, but to the Soviet leader.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Christopher Andrew, whose new book is called Defend the Realm, A Centenary History of MI5. Let's go next to Arlington and speak with Tom. Hi, Tom.
Hi, I'm looking forward to reading your book, and I was wondering if you'd comment on the role of secret societies like Freemasonry on the history of British intelligence, and these things seem to turn up in books by Peter Wright on MI5 and Ian Fleming from MI6 all the way back to Elizabethan times with John Dee and 007.
Yeah.
Is that influence still around today in MI5 with, you know, women in management and all the changes that have taken place recently?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that the influence of Freemasons in British history, it's really exciting fiction, but I don't think it amounts to too much in actual fact. But, you know, you've hit upon a really very important point. The way that I would interpret the point is as follows. I mean, intelligence is the only profession in the world in which fictional characters are far, far better known than any real intelligence officers or agents who ever lived. Now, even though my book is selling reasonably well, I'm not going to be able to compete with Dan Brown and people who write spy fiction. I think we'll always have a bigger market than those who write how it really was. But let's take the example of James Bond. You know, a majority of the world's population have seen James Bond films, and I think it is fair to say that just as stories about Freemasons, some of which are really very exciting, and I've given the one example, it's people view of British intelligence is more influenced by films they've seen and occasionally novels that they've read about James Bond than any of the real exploits. So fact and fiction tend to get woven together. But there's an advantage for British intelligence in this, and it's this, that the world's best-known intelligence officer, fictional intelligence officer, James Bond, is a Brit. And people tend to like James Bond films. So I do think it's been, curiously enough, a recruitment advantage to us around the world.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Maggie in Fort Worth. Hi, Maggie.
Hi. I have an interest in a program that I saw years ago on BBC, or it was a PBS thing, Riley, Ace of Spies. And I remember reading about him at the time that they weren't even sure if he was British or Russian or where he ended up or where he came from. I'm wondering if you can shed any light on his history, and I'll take the answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Okay, Nadi, thank you very much for your question. Sidney Riley was, like some people in the world of intelligence have been, 50% brilliant and 50% a fraud. He was a fantasist. Here's one of his ideas. He believed immediately after the Russian Revolution in 1917 that the way to bring down the Bolsheviks was actually to humiliate Lenin, the leader of the revolution, and Trotsky, who almost succeeded in but didn't quite, humiliate them. What was he going to do? He was going to remove their trousers and parade them in public in the Russian capital. So in the end, Sidney Riley, I think, belongs really rather more the world of spy fiction than he does to the world of spy reality, although there was certainly somebody called Sidney Reilly. But the series that you're referring to, which was Reilly, Ace of Spies, I think contained far more fiction than it did reality.
There have been times throughout its history when MI5 have had to fight pretty hard against mandates that its leaders felt overstepped their boundaries. For example, political pressure to push back against labor activists and peace activists. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Well, one of the things that most surprised me as I was looking through the files, you know, there is a well-established myth that MI5, during the Cold War, kept looking for Reds under the beds, sometimes found Reds in beds, and then went off to try and persuade a bored government that Russian subversion, communist subversion, Soviet subversion was a real problem. Actually, it's usually the other way around. So just to give one example, and my book contains a facsimile of this particular document. In 1961, the Labour leadership, the leader, the deputy leader, and one of the other leading Labour politicians, they bring to MI5 a list of 16 Labour members of Parliament who they believe are really communists, and another 9 who they suspect are really communists. MI5 listens politely, says it's not going to do anything because this is party politics and it doesn't get involved in party politics. But once the representative of the Labour leadership, Labour Party leadership, has gone, they all agree that Labour Party leadership once again is getting too exercised about the problem of communist subversion within the Labour Party. Well, they were generally right, but they did get something wrong. The name at the top of the list, and the list, as I've said, is published in the book, says W. Owen, Will Owen, Member of Parliament for Morpeth. We now know that he had joined the Czechoslovak Security Intelligence Service as an agent in 1954, and they were reporting, of course, to the Russians, and he wasn't caught until 1970. And even in 1970, there was enough evidence to drive him out of Parliament, but there wasn't enough evidence to find him guilty in a court of law. So I would say that really for most of the Cold War, it's governments rather than MI5 which tends to exaggerate the influence of communist subversion within Britain.
Christopher Andrew is with us. His new book is called Defend the Realm, A Centenary History of MI5. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at Cambridge University, Christopher Andrew. His new book is called Defend the Realm, A Centenary History of MI5. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from David in Plano who writes, "It seems the British citizenry is more comfortable with having a government agency spy on themselves than people in the U.S. would tolerate. Is this indeed the case? And if so, does this greater acceptance give MI5 a leg up on anti-terrorist activities over their U.S. counterparts?"
What a wonderful question. I think the answer is probably yes. I mean, I should say there's a very strictly regulated system. If MI5 wants to tap somebody's phone to keep them under surveillance, it has to go to the Home Secretary, the Home Office, essentially the Interior Ministry, as it would be called in other country. And it has to make a personal application to the Home Secretary himself or herself. And they have to sign a warrant allowing MI5 to do this. So it's not something that it can do just if it feels like doing it. And having been through the files, you know, and the files were laid down long before anybody thought that an outside historian might come and stick his nose into them, I would say it's stuck by that. So even though not everybody feels like this, I mean, I think that one of the reasons why it is comparatively accepted is that it goes back to before the First World War, and it's a system which I think has been very little abused.
Can you talk for a minute, Chris, about how you decided to pick your battles with regard to things that you thought deserved publication in the book that MI5 might have pushed back on and said, we're not sure this should go in?
Yeah, the major problems I had were not with MI5. It was with other parts of government.
Chris, are you with us? Okay.
There's bound to be sort of a gray area. Let me give you an example of a gray area. When I began writing it, I took the view that anybody who had been an agent for MI5, 30, 40, 50 years ago, well, there's no need to keep that secret any longer. But, of course, the reason why British intelligence, I think, finds it easier to convince its current agents that it's not going to give their secrets away is that it doesn't give away the secrets of past agents away as well. There's going to be arguments about this. And let me give you an example. Two of the most successful double agents in British history were actually Americans, and they go back to the First World War. The name of one of them you will find in the book. The name of the other one is, believe it or not, still top secret.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, yes, we can hear you.
Yeah.
You said that the other one is still top secret.
So the sound is okay. I was saying that as an example of the kinds of things which it can be very difficult to decide is whether a secret of 50 years ago is still something that should be kept today. Well, broadly speaking, I don't think that is the case. But there is one area in which professional intelligence officers tend to take a different view, and it's this. Even if you don't need to keep the secret of somebody who worked for you 50 years ago, the fact is that if you reveal his or her name now, what that's going to do is discourage current agents from carrying on working for you, because they're going to think that, perhaps they're going to give away my secrets as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to Marshall in Dallas. Hello, Marshall.
Yes. I was wondering, what is your opinion of Peter Wright's contention that Sir Roger Hollis, one time head of MI5, was a Soviet mole? And what do you think of Mr. Wright in general?
Well, I could give a pretty quick reply to that. The allegation that Sir Roger Hollis, head of MI5 from 1956 to 1965 for 9 years, was a Soviet mole is rubbish. And Peter Wright became an embittered individual later in his career, and I don't take most of what he said seriously. What I would say, though, is that the success of Peter Wright's personal fantasies owed very much to mishandling by the British government. Because when he brought out the book, which sold, I seem to recall, 900,000 copies in hardback in the United States just over 20 years ago, it was banned by the British government. Now, of course, the British government banning a book, what did that do? It didn't stop people buying it. It simply meant that it sold probably 100 times as many copies, and I would defend the use of 100 times. More than it would have done otherwise. And there was a comical period in Britain after that in which other authors sought to turn their books into bestsellers by saying that it was about to be banned by the British government, or it ought to have been banned by the British government, and so on. So this is one of those stories in which everybody comes badly out of it. Peter Wright comes badly out of it. The British government comes badly out of it. The innocent victim, of course, was Roger Hollis. And as my book shows, the reason why that was complete nonsense is in the whole of MI5, in the Second World War, you had to pick somebody who was beginning to fight the Cold War even before the Cold War began, who was saying, hang on a moment, despite the fact we're fighting war against Germany, we must keep noting down the names of all communists that we can note, and so on. In other words, he went far beyond anything that he might have needed to do for cover. No, his reputation was disgracefully treated by Peter Wright. It caused great distress within the family, and I hope that once and for all, I've nailed Peter Wright's lies.
800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Carrollton and speak with Anthony. Hi, Anthony.
Hello. I was recently reading a biography by the children's author Roald Dahl, and it stated that he was actually in the British Intelligence Agency at some point. I was curious how common it would be for someone in his position, fairly well known, to have been pulled over to do that kind of work.
Well, that's a wonderful question, and you've hit upon, I think, a really important point. One of the reasons why the double-cross system, British deception, during the Second World War was so successful is that they got in a number of really good writers. You mentioned one, Dennis Wheatley, I suppose the best-known black magic writer in British fiction of the late 20th century, was also involved. But what tends to be forgotten is that two things. One is, I would say, the only one of the creative arts in which the Brits were number one during the 20th century, clearly number one, and the remain so in the 21st century, was actually spy fiction. You know, whether you go to the most popular end of the market, in other words, James Bond, or you go to the more serious end of the market, John le Carré, the Brits come out as number one. But what tends to be forgotten is that the best-selling British spy writers, not merely of modern times, but just rather earlier on, were actually former members of British intelligence themselves. So one of the things, I think, that makes their novels and the films that are based on them so successful is that it's a mixture of their own personal experience as intelligence officers and their imagination as spy novelists.
You know, it's interesting that the caller mentioned Roald Dahl, because that certainly speaks to the requirement of a sense of humor that you mentioned earlier in the hour.
Yes.
Is it typically a sense of gallows humor?
No, I don't think so. It's a sense of the ridiculous. I mean, my own view is, you know, I'm not trying to convert anybody to the view, is that you know, it's far too often a sense of humor is simply thought of, you know, useful social add-on, you know, the ability to amuse other people. Well, you know, it is that. But unless you have some sense of the ridiculous, my view is that you don't have a sense of proportion, the ability to tell the really desperately serious from other matters. So I think it is MI5, which was the first of the world's major intelligence agencies, who spotted as early as the First World War that this is a characteristic that they would be looking for in their new recruits.
Let's go back to the phones once again. This time we'll speak with Jim in Dallas. Hey, Jim.
Hi. I have a quick question. I wanted to know, a rather broad question, really. Why do governments make the decision to involve themselves in espionage? And I'll take my answer off there. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Why do governments involve themselves in espionage? Well, I mean, that's just about the most basic question that it's possible to ask about intelligence. And I think the reason is this, that all those who wish us ill, and, you know, that's true of every level, from being a burglar to those people in Al-Qaeda who at the very moment are planning to explode dirty bombs in the United States and the United Kingdom, they make their plans in secret. So what are the options? You've only two options. One, you wait until they attack you at Pearl Harbor or a 9/11, or you try and find out their plans before they attack you. Now, sometimes you'll succeed, and sometimes you won't. But there are only two alternatives. One is to allow people to plot in secret and wait until they attack, and the other is to try to discover their secrets before they attack. And I'm clearly in favor of the second option.
Chris, beyond simply identifying sort of rising enemies to the state, how do you imagine that MI5 is poised to change and evolve over the 21st century?
Well, what I think is not going to go away quickly is the threat of transnational terrorism. Why do I think that? The reason I think that MI5 was too slow to get on, and as were plenty of the rest of the world, too slow to get on to the threat from transnational terrorism was that it didn't take the long view. I would like to think that it does now. But Winston Churchill, who understood intelligence better than any other politician in British history up to and including his own time, he said this: the further backward you look, the further forward you can see. Now, the tiny minority of terrorism experts, in particular an American called Bruce Hoffman, who took the very long view in the mid-1990s, realized that the main terrorist threat of the early 21st century was going to be holy terror, Islamist terrorism. Now, this is still in its very early stages. After all, 9/11 is less than a decade ago. The most serious terrorist attack in British history was mounted by people who were seeking to create a 9/11 in Britain, and their trial concluded only a few months ago, in September 2009. This, you may recall, was the attempt to get suicide bombers into 9 planes leaving from Heathrow Airport in London, heading across the Atlantic to great cities in the United States and in Canada over a three-hour period. So if it was realized that there was a suicide bomber on board any one of them, it would be too late to do anything anything about it. Now, the reason why it didn't succeed was that, fortunately, MI5 had these people under surveillance for quite some time. MI5 doesn't get everything right all the time, but it has had a series of very considerable successes. Now, the most recent terrorist incident, which came incredibly, worryingly close to success, happened, after all, on Christmas Day, when a suicide bomber almost succeeded in blowing up an aircraft over a great North American city. I see no sign whatever that terrorist offensive, it will fluctuate, and we're rather better at dealing with it than we used to be. But that is going to go on for some time. So what I see the next generation as is a mixture of continuity and change. The Islamist terrorist offensive will continue, and other threats, which can't be immediately foreseen, will emerge at the same time.
We have just a few seconds left, and I have to ask, having studied intelligence history throughout your career, did you spend your boyhood hoping to be a spy?
No, I would have been no good at it. I mean, perhaps I shouldn't joke about it too much, but it was pretty humiliating when I was a student at Cambridge. You know, I was approached neither by British intelligence nor the KGB. I've led to get over that.
Christopher Andrew is professor of modern and contemporary history at Cambridge University. His new book is called Defend the Realm, A Centenary History of MI5. Chris, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you very much, Chris, for inviting me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.